Roughly.
Yeah, we're going to be learning a Gemara in Sota on Daf Tes. That's what Rabbi Myers told me that we're going to be learning today. So I hope. I hope that we'll.
We've got right down to the bottom.
Down to the bottom. Okay, so he told me to start a little bit before the bottom. So this Gemara, again, this will be review if he got down to the bottom. We're starting 9 lines up from the bottom. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 lines up from the bottom. Darash Rabbi Chinina Bar Papa. Now what we're about to learn, as you know, is an Agadita, right? All Shas divides into two. There's Halacha and there's Agada. Now Agada itself...
Is it possible to open the window?
It's hard for me. If you don't mind opening it.
Yeah,
yeah, thanks, John.
Just
give it a little extra zest.
Sorry, you're right. We need a bit of air because it's very...
Now, Agadita, in my understanding, fits into one of two categories. Either it's something that we can't understand at all, it's esoteric, and we don't have the keys or the Misora, what's called the tradition, we don't know how to unlock the mystery of the Agadita. Or alternatively, the Agadita fits into a different category and it speaks to us. And we can understand it, and we can derive one of two things, either emunah, either faith, or we could derive some sort of ethical message about how we should lead our lives. The Agadita that we're about to learn together, and some of it will be a chazara for you, I think fits into the second category, namely it's an Agadita that we can understand, and moreover, it's meaningful for us. It will give us an ethical lesson. It will give us emunah and faith in God that could be very inspiring. So again, if the Agadita is inspiring, take it. If it doesn't inspire you, then leave it out. My Rebbe used to skip Agadita because he knew that we didn't have the ability, we didn't have the kelim, what we call the keys, to open up, to unlock the mystery of Agadita. There's so many Agaditas. For example, Baba Basra, there's one Agadita. It's called Rabba Barbar Chana. The whole thing is weird. I mean, it's stories about, you know, shipwrecks with large fishes, and the whole thing is just, and we don't have the way of interpreting it. It's like when I was in college, I took a course in poetry. So I don't know if you ever studied poetry, but if you study poetry, like, you never know what the poet had in mind. And maybe the poet had nothing in mind. I don't know, but you know, the question is what you can. It's kind of like, you know, by association, does it trigger off some sort of message? Now, the first part of this Agadita, I think, has a very profound message of emunah for us. Now, let me give you what I think is the appropriate contemporary introduction to this Agadita. And you'll tell me if you like it or you don't like it. It's up to you. After the so-called deal in Gaza, when the Jewish community was completely uprooted and many, many problems arose for those families that had to leave, what happened to the She'eris? She'eris means whatever the Jews left in Gaza. There were synagogues, there were buildings. What happened to it? Anybody know?
Destroyed.
Completely destroyed. If you would go down to Gaza today, as I did when I was serving in the IDF, you would not see any remnants whatsoever
destroyed
of the
by
fact
also by, them.
By them. They destroyed it. Now what that means is that there were Jewish communities that put their life into building, and it's all gone, all wiped off the face of the earth. When the Israeli people who lived in those areas left Gaza, they believed that there would be at least a memory of the synagogues that they built and so forth and so on. But the enemy said, blot out any memory. The inspiration that we'll get from this Gemara is that although in Jewish history, unfortunately, we were not zocha too frequently to such a thing that we're going to see here with regard to Moshe and David, where there's something left, even after we are defeated, there's still something that we built that's left. Most of Jewish history is like what we saw in Gaza. We could have predicted it, that when the Jewish communities would be uprooted, the Arabs would come and destroy every vestige, any sort of thought about the Jewish people ever living there. And they would claim, you know, this was ours from the start. And we weren't zocher to leave some sort of an impact behind us. We go into exile, we leave our communities, and we are forced, we are uprooted. Can at least we say we built something that maybe now it's not under our control, but maybe someday we have hope to come back to it. And that's going to be an emunah inspiration that we're going to get from Moshe and from David. David is going to build something, and even later on it's going to remain. Moshe Rabbeinu is going to build what's called an Ohel Moed back in the time of the Mishkan, and miraculously it will stand. So let's just, John, I'll come right back to you. I just want to read through the Gemara. I know you've gone through this Gemara, but this is the message I got on my phone that I'm supposed to start from this. So I go by the phone. Anyway, Dorash Rav Chinana Bar Papa Maidichsiv Rananu Tzadikim Bashem Laisharim Navasihila. And here we have something called Al Tikri. This is a classic methodology where in Hilchas Troshos we're allowed to take a word, look at its root, and rewrite the text as if the root of the word appeared. Al Tikri Nava Sihila, El Nave Sihila. Nave is a beautiful building or location, something that was built up that's called Nave. And Tihila, here in this context, means it's for all eternity, all posterity. This building that was created continues to exist. And when did God actually fulfill this divine promise of Laisharim Navati Hila, that the creations of the Yesharim, of those who are dedicated to Hashem, will be forever? Is Moshe and David. Shelo Sholtu Soneinem Bimasehem. That even when the enemies, the Soneim, came and they destroyed us, nevertheless, Lo Sholtu, they weren't able to destroy Masehem, those creations of the Yesharim. David, where do you see it? David, Dechsiv, Tav'u Be'eret Shareo. And it means that Tav'u, we're referring to something that's submerged under the ground. Shareo means its gates. And we're talking about the gates of Nove. Nove is a reference to the Beit HaMikdash. So David HaMelech has Sha'arim, he's got gates of the Beit HaMikdash. The Jewish people go into exile, and yet the gates of the Mikdash were not destroyed. Of course, the enemies would have loved to destroy any remnants of the Jewish community. They would plow the field of the Beit of the Harabayas, as the Gemara says at the end of Makkos. You remember the story of Rabbi Akiva, that Zechariah Novi and Rabbi Akiva saw that the entire ground of the Beit HaMikdash was completely plowed over, and his colleagues started crying. He was happy. The whole story there, but yet with regard to the Sharim, the gates of David's Beit HaMikdash. Now we'll get back to the question of David. Did he really build the Beit HaMikdash? Actually, who built the Beit HaMikdash? Shlomo. It was his son Solomon. But in any event, it says that the enemies wanted to destroy everything completely, but there was a great miracle that something would remain. Something would remain from David's Mesiras Nefesh. He put in work, he put in toil, he was dedicated, and with a great deal of love, he set the entire stage preparing the Beis HaMikdash, and what was created here, the Sha'arim, the gates, they sunk into the ground. What does it mean they sunk into the ground? The enemies were not able to destroy them. Imagine if you had something that was of value and you knew that your adversaries wanted to destroy it, but that something had a life of its own and it could always run away from your adversaries. It would automatically duck into a subterranean tunnel. That's what happened to David HaMelech's She'arim. And this is God saying to David about David, your She'arim are La Yesharim Nova Tehillah. Tehillah means it'll be a Tehillah for all times. And it could be that when the third Migdash of Yiras Hashem will be rebuilt, we're going to again, what's the opposite of submerge? To emerge? I don't know. We're going to be able to cause the Sha'arim to emerge from below the ground. And Moshe, the same thing happens with regard to Moshe. The Omar Mar Mishim Nivne Migdash Rishon Nignaz Oel Moed. And it goes through details about all the different parts of the Ol Moed. This was the tabernacle. This was the tabernacle that Moshe built in the, again with the help of Bezalel, but he built it in the desert. And the elements of that tabernacle will be somehow hidden. Nignaz means they'll be hidden underground, so that even later when the final Migdash will replace the Mishkan of Shlom of Moshe, nevertheless that which Moshe contributed, that which he created, will still be around. And that's a great message of Emunah that we can take. You know, when you think about it, Rome was famous for its edifices. They created structures. Today, you go to Rome, you'll see the Colosseum. That's about it. I mean, basically all the ancient structures of Rome are gone. And what Chazal trying to say is that God has a special feeling for Yesharim, that those Jewish great ancestors, that are giants, that put in so much work for the sake of building on behalf of the Almighty. Maybe we weren't the greatest architects, but nevertheless, on a spiritual level, our architecture is very, very unique, and God will protect it as He did in the case of David, in the case of Moshe. If you take a look at Rashi, David dechsiv tavu v'aret sharel liel mine. Earlier it says in the pasuk, Chashav Hashem lahashchis chomas bas tzion, that God thought that since the Jewish people sinned and they didn't deserve the big dash, He would destroy it all. But nevertheless, after that pasuk, the next verse says tavu v'aret shareha. Now David built what's called the city of David, Ir David, and he built a mitzuda, and he built his house in that city, which you can go to and visit even today. The archaeologists are still digging up things there in what they call Ir David. And Rashi says that in the Ir David there were she'arim that were built, and those she'arim somehow are submerged underneath the ground. So again, even though throughout Jewish history, as I mentioned at the outset, in modern Jewish history, we've lost a lot of the vestiges of what we created with our hands, all that we built, but there's a message of optimism and faith in the She'arim of David that are somewhere under the ground, and the Mishkan of Moshe was not destroyed, it's somewhere under the ground, and that's called La Yesharim Nova Sehila. I have to share this Gemara with my daughter because her name is Nava Tehillah. That's my daughter's name, Nava Tehillah. So I never knew about this Gemara until Rabbi Myers asked me to teach this class. So I got to teach it and teach it to her. Now this is one message in the Agadah which I call Emunah, faith. That we have to have faith and optimism, that our job is to create, is to build. Perhaps, you know, David and Moshe are the paradigmic giants because they never gave up hope. And Moshe Rabbeinu realized that, you know, God had decreed he wouldn't enter into the land, but yet he built the Mishkan with all of his love and all of his efforts. And David HaMelech knew that he had many adversaries, starting with Shaul and then Avshalom, and it goes on and on. But yet, he had that faith. Now, what are these she'arim? After all, who built the Beis HaMikdash, the first Mikdash? It was Shlomo HaMelech. So what are we talking about, the Sha'arim of David? And the answer is, now here I have to give you a little bit of lumdus. You know what lumdus is? That's conceptual halakhic learning. There are two dimensions to the Beis HaMikdash. One dimension is called, I should probably write this on the board, but you never take notes anyway, so it's a waste of time. One dimension is called Kiddushas Makom. And the other is called Kiddushas Mechitzos. Now, Kiddushas Mechitzos is something that was created, generated by Shlomo. Shlomo actually built all the walls and the Kaslei Beis HaMikdash. That's Mechitzos. Kiddushas Makom is when you designate a place, in this case, in this context, for the Beis HaMikdash, even though you haven't built the Mikdash yet. So you don't have Kiddushas Mechitzos, you only have the Kiddushas Makom. It's like an abstract kind of sanctity. And David HaMelech, although he did not build Kiddushas Mechitzos, but he did engender what's called Kiddushas Makom. And he sought out the place for the Mikdash. He purchased the land from Arnona Yavusi, and he collected the money from all the Shvatim, and he designated. The Gemara says in Masechta Zvachim that the Kedusha of Mikdash is Ad HaTahom. Tahom means the center of the universe. What's it called in English? Oh, we'll call it the center of the universe, right? Deep down, there's some sort of fire, you know. The epicenter of the universe. So that David HaMelech's Kiddush went all the way down, because that's the Kiddushas Makom. The Kiddushas Makom is not limited to the airspace above the ground. It goes even below the ground. Now, if that be the case, it makes sense that the Sha'arim, which were above the ground, were just a sign. They weren't the actual Mechitzas of the Beis HaMikdash, but they were a sign. This is the place that was designated. By the way, does the Torah ever tell us where this place is located?
No.
What is the phrase that repeats itself over and over? You can do a word search. Hamakom asher yivchar Hashem. The place that God will choose. The Torah is unusually secretive, concealing that place. And the Rambam, you know, wrote a book called Moral in Avuchim, The Guide to the Perplexed. He writes that the reason why the Torah deliberately omitted the location of the place is because if God had revealed the location of the place, then all the nations of the world would have attacked and claimed ownership to that place. And if you look at the Makom HaMikdash today and Jerusalem, you'll see all sorts of flags, you know, Palestinian flags, and then there are big churches with Christian flags and this and the French, and everybody's claiming this is, the Crusaders claimed that we're going to conquer the land. Everybody wanted the Makom HaMikdash. So the Rambam says that the Torah went out of its way to conceal, it's a Makom HaShem Yivchar Hashem, particularly ambiguous. Who is the one in Jewish history who would determine which is the Makom for the Beis HaMikdash?
David HaMelech.
Because David HaMelech created Kiddushas Makom, HaMakom HaShem Yivchar Hashem. And the Sha'arim were meant to be a sign, an indication that this place is designated for the future Mikdash. Who's going to actually build a Mikdash with Kiddushas Mechitzos?
Shlomo.
So it's a joint effort.
Didn't determine it. It was revealed to him where it would fit.
Correct, by Nosan HaNavi. Oh no, by God HaNavi, I think it was. Right. So the Navi revealed to him where it is, because we didn't know exactly where the place is. But once David got privy to the information, he bought the land and established the Kedushas Makom. Again, we could go on and on, but I don't know if you ever heard of Bamos. Bamos is a private altar. Once David HaMelech determined that Makom, you could not make a private altar, because then it was a Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem. So even though David didn't build the Mikdash with Kedushas Mechitzos, but nevertheless, Kedushas Makom was enough to engender an Iser Bamos. Again, this is a long discussion, but I'm just giving you a flavor of, we shouldn't knock David off the map as far as Beis HaMikdash is concerned. David played a major role. And the Mishkan, of course, is Moshe Rabbeinu. His impact, Chazal say that he erected nobody knows exactly how he did it, there was some supernatural miracle, but Moshe Rabbeinu actually erected the entire Mishkan. One person. How did he do it? Nobody knows. So the architect was Bezalel, but Moshe was the one who erected the Mikdash. And all the parts of the Mikdash, the Gemara here gives a whole list of different parts of the Mikdash. It's called Krush of Adonov, Karsav, Rechav. You know, you have the you have the crushing on the beams and the different bolts and maybe I can borrow this for a second. I'll just read the different parts. Does he tell you what the list is here? Just to save us time. Where is it? Yeah, bars, beams, hooks, pillars, sockets. Okay, you'll go through all the different parts of the Mishkan.
They contribute to
Now, the second part of the Agadata that we're about to embark upon here, that starts here at the bottom of Daf Tes and goes on to Tes Amud Beis, this is what I call ethics. This is not about emunah, about faith. This is about ethics. Now, Jewish ethics, once again, has two different aspects to it. One aspect is what we call schar v'onish, reward and punishment. And the goal of reward and punishment is twofold. Number one, it's to teach us that life is serious. You can't just do what you want to do. You know, you think, well, I was granted freedom, I don't care about other people's feelings, etc., etc. Reward and punishment is always there, like an albatross around your neck, to teach you that you have to be dedicated to ethical principles. And if not, you're going to suffer the consequences. And many religions believe, well, God is a good guy, you know, he's got the big G on his sweatshirt, he'll always be compassionate, he'll overlook what I'm doing. You know, that's not a Jewish approach. One of the 13 principles of our faith is schar v'onish. And Chazal go out of their way in many, many different Gemaras to teach us how harsh punishment could be. So that's one dimension of reward and punishment. But Jewish ethics has another dimension which is entirely independent of reward and punishment. And that is, we have to appreciate and evaluate the impact of our actions. Not on ourselves, that's already reward and punishment, but the impact of our actions on others. And lest the person think I'm Robinson Crusoe, I live in an island in isolation, Chazal are going to teach us over and over again that you live in a society, you live in a community, and others will suffer as a result of your actions. And that's a very profound ethical challenge, that we should always be aware of the fact that others are going to be affected by our actions. So let's take the case of a sota. One perspective is that the sota is selfishly involved in our own goals, our own pleasures. You know, she finds this relationship very romantic and so forth. But the other dimension is, what's its impact? What's its impact upon two major people? One is her husband, and the other is the boel, the person, the adulterer with which she had adultery. So she thinks, you know what, she can go ahead and have this relationship. You know, this is her own decision. She has freedom, and no one's going to be affected by it. And we're going to use now the principle of reward and punishment to teach her the ethical principle that she is having an impact. She can't make a decision just based on herself. It's like the marshal of two people in a ship, and one person starts drilling a hole in the bottom of the ship. So the other one says the ship is going to sink. So he says, I'm only drilling a hole in my side of the ship. Tadar Rabbanon, take a look at the Braisa, three lines up before the end. Sota nasna eino b'misha eino roila. Now, one of the most important ethical principles here is jealousy, not to be jealous. And all of life is one continuous challenge about jealousy. Some people are jealous on a very material level. They see, you know, the Joneses, they have all the good, they go on cruises. You know, today if you don't go on a cruise, you're a nobody, right? And they're jealous because they don't have the funds to go on a cruise. That's one level of jealousy. But then there's a much more sophisticated and spiritual level of jealousy. For example, the Gemara says that kinas sofer mar bechachma. If you're jealous of someone else's knowledge, he knows more than you, that's something positive. That kinah will give you the impetus to study more and be more diligent. But let's say you're jealous of someone who has more students than you have. That's not acceptable. So if you you look to your right and to your left and you are unhappy with your situation in life, you only have 3 students, 5 students, 10 students, and he has 20 students and 100 students. You know, today everything's on the internet. So you can actually go on the internet in certain sites like Torah Anytime, YU Torah, and many other sites, and you can figure out who are the most popular lecturers. Because each one gets X number of hits. So somebody could say, well, no one's listening to my classes, you know, and get very jealous about that. So there's an ethical principle here that God is in charge and He wants you to have what you have. She decides, this sota, that she wants something that she cannot have. And this is a terrible jealousy. When a person feels unhappy about their lot in life, then it creates ethical problems. So nasna eina b'misheino roila. Emphasize those 4 words. Misha eino roila. You know, it's bad enough I'm jealous because you have something that I don't have, but if I take something from you because it's not for me, but it was meant for someone else, that's the most serious, or shall I say, fundamental violation of morality and ethics. Masha Biksha, now she has to know that reward and punishment is going to convey a very important message to her. Masha Biksha, that which she wanted, an ongoing relationship with this adulterer, lo nitan lo. We have Eidim, we have witnesses, we're going to take her to drink for the Meimorarim, and she's not going to get it. And Masha Biyada Natluah Mimena. It's not only that she didn't get what she was trying to get, but even what she had is going to be taken away. Look how severe the punishment is. The Gemara now is going to talk about the Nachash HaKadmoni. Imagine the Nachash HaKadmoni. Chazal is going to tell us that he wanted to have an intimate relationship with Chava. And again, it's hard for us to understand that, but again, the Nachash HaKadmoni, the original serpent, didn't look like our serpents, because our serpents are after the curse. And therefore, the Nachash was looking for something that lo nitan lo, that was not given to him. I mean, Chava was designated for Adam HaRishon. And at the end, not only is the Nachash going to be cursed, that human beings, including Chava, hate the Nachash, but moreover, he's going to lose his entire stature. He's going to be reduced to afar, to crawling on the ground, eating the dust of the earth. And therefore, Masha Biyado Nitla Himeno. Imagine the punishment here. It's a double punishment. Not only are we going to deny you, is God going to deny you what you tried to take from someone else, but in addition, what you have on your own is going to be taken from you. In other words, if you don't trust the ownership rights of someone else, then God says, I'm not going to trust your ownership rights. We're going to take away, measure for measure, what you own. And Rashi says that, Masha biyodo notlo mimena. Take a look at the last Rashi on the daf. He says, imshosa mayim, if she's going to drink these bitter waters, mesa, she's going to die. So she certainly did not achieve her goal. She didn't get him, the adulterer, and she certainly didn't get her husband. She got nothing. She just got death. V'im hodasa. And if, on the other hand, she confesses her guilt and she doesn't drink from the Meimarim, and that's what the whole procedure is trying to evoke a confession from her, is Nesra Labayla. Number one, she can no longer return to her husband, so that marriage relationship is gone. Number two, Hifsida Ksubasa, she loses her rights in marriage to collect the Ksuba. And number three, she's not even allowed to have an ongoing relationship with the adulterer. That's called Echel Abal and Echel Aboel. And the Gemara says, the last line here, Kol Anosei Neinu V'Masha Eino Shelo. If a person looks to try to take away that which is not designated, allotted for him, Masha Mevakesh, ain't no still law, what he wants will not be given to him. Umasha Biyadu, no limit, that which he has, he's going to lose. B'chein matzinu b'nachash hakadmoni. We find the same thing with regard to the original sin of the nachash. She nasan einov b'masha eino roilo. He looked towards something that wasn't his, that wasn't designated for him, it was designated for someone else. If you take a look at Rashi on the top of Daf Tes Amid Beis, Rashi says that he had some sort of an intimate relationship with Chava. Again, I don't know if you want to take that literally, that's up to you. V'hainu d'ksiv ha-nochas hi-si'ani. Hi-si'ani is mi-loshon nisuin, nisuin marriage. Loshon tashmish mi-nisuin hu. So he tried to take away that which belongs to Adam HaRishon, and at the end, not only lo nasnu lo, not only mashabikesh lo nasnu lo, that which he tried to get, they wouldn't give to him, because at the end of the day, the pasuk says that he was cursed and that mankind would hate the nachash, so she would not have any relationship with him. But mashabiyado, even what he had, natlua mimenu, was taken away from him. Rashi says, koma zakufa. Again, there are a lot of things that were taken away from the nachash as a result of the klala, the curse of the divine curse. But Rashi puts his emphasis on koma zakufa, that the nachash stood on 2 feet like a human being, and that indicates the stature of the nachash, and all this was taken away from him. Omar Kodesh Baruch, ani amarti, he was meant to be, in the original plan, the king of all the animals. The achshav, and now oruhu, he's the cursed, the most cursed of all the creatures on the face of the earth. Mikol behemim kol chayis asod. And he amarti, I said, yelech bekomis kufa, he'll walk straight upright. The achshav, now al gechono yelech, he's going to crawl on his belly. And he amarti, yehei macholo machol adam, he should eat and consume the food of man. Achshav afar yevchal, now he's going to eat from the afar. Omar, he said, he was jealous and he wanted to marry Chava. He says, I'm going to kill Adam HaRishon and marry Chava. Achshav, now don't even dream of marrying Chava, because Eva Oshes Beinecho Beino Isha Ubein Zarachu Bein Zara, I'm going to put enmity and hatred between you and all of mankind, including Chava. And v'chein matzinu, the Gemara says, we find the same thing, not only with regard to the Sota, and back in the day, the Nachash HaKadmoni, but I'm going to give you a list of, I think it's 10 people throughout Jewish history, who tried to take that which is not theirs, and at the end they even lost that which was theirs. And Rashi goes through all these 10 cases. Number one, Kayin. Now there's a whole story here about Kayin. I'm trying to find the Rashi here. There it is, Kayin, at the end of the second line. Rashi says, Nasan eno bita'oma yisera shenoldem hot hevel. That when Hevel was born, he had 2 other sisters that were born with him, 2 twins. Vinoldu imo, v'ayinu d'ksiv es achiv es hevel, shnei achim and shnei ribuyim. And Kayin wanted to take away the woman that was designated to be married to Hevel. And as a result, he would suffer and he was sent into banishment. He would not get what he wanted and he would lose even that which he had. And then we have Korach. Right? Korach wanted to, you know, he wanted to take away the kahuna from Aaron. And at the end, he and all his cohorts went down, 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 below the ground. They were swallowed up. Nivla, Rashi says. And his Bilam, right? Bilam was hoping to get the good money from Balak, and he would curse the Jewish people. And at the end, he was murdered. Then his Doeg is Avir HaRoim. He was one of the great shepherds of Israel, Gadol Shevet Talmidim Haya. But he got jealous of David.
Knowledge.
What do you say?
To our knowledge, he was jealous of David.
Oh, you see, what does he say here? He was jealous. Oh, I see. Okay, I was just reading the Rashi. Shera'o Navon B'David. He saw how wise David HaMelech was. Vishtar Maraponim, he was so beautiful, and he would show Maraponim Alochi, he would indicate what the Alochi is. Kedeksiv Hine Ra'isi Ben Liishai Beis Alachmi. And the Agada tells us in Chelek at the end of Sanhedrin, the Kol Aposik Hazeh Doeg Omer B'Loshin Hara, and Doeg was jealous, and at the end, everything was taken away from him. And then we have Achitofel, Gechazi, Avshalom, Adonoi, and Uzio, and Haman. You know, Haman was jealous because Mordechai refused to bow down to him, so he wanted to destroy the Jewish people. At the end, he was hung up from a tree. And what's common to all the above, Gehazi is very interesting because you remember there was a guy named Naaman. Naaman was the second in command in Ashur. And after Elisha saved Naaman from leprosy, so Naaman wanted to give gifts, and Elisha refused to accept the gifts. He felt it was a kiddush Hashem if he would not take these gifts. And Gehazi starts running after Naaman. He says, "Oh, give me all the gifts." Mm-hmm. And at the end, Gehazi, terrible things happen to Gehazi. Achitofel was jealous of Melucha, and Adonio wanted to marry. He wanted to abscond with David Amel's wife named Avishag. He was killed. Uzio also wanted the kahuna, and he at the end became a mitzaras. I mean, every one of these individuals, not only did they fail in achieving their agenda and getting something that doesn't belong to them, but as a result, that which they had was taken away from them, and in most cases here on this list, they were absolutely destroyed. So this is a great agadita because it should inspire us in two ways. Number one, in the case of Moshe and David, it should inspire us to create, and hopefully God will protect those creations, and that's the divine providence. And number two, the ethics of not wanting something that belongs to someone else. It's not designated for you. That everyone should, in the Gemara, the Mishnah says in Avos, Eza Sameach, who's considered a happy person, is Sameach Bechelko. He's happy with his lot. And that's a great challenge for a person to be happy with their lot. And to want something from someone else to take it away, that's even more of a sin. Not only is he not happy with his lot, he wants to make someone else unhappy. Then at the end he's going to lose even that which is rightfully his. Shenosnu einem b'mesha eino roi lehem. And now the Gemara is up to the whole story about the sota and how we get her to drink, the whole process by which the ritual we get her to drink for the main marim. And it starts with a quote from the Mishnah. Let's go back to the Mishnah. What time is that? I lost my 10:15. All right, we have another 5 minutes. Let's see, where is the Mishnah? Oh, here's the Mishnah on Daf Ches Amud Beis, and the Mishnah says that Birech Hischila Ba'avera Tchila V'ach. Right, I'm sorry. B'Yerech Hischila Ba'avera. Her Avera begins with Yerech. Yerech, I think, in English would be a thigh. A thigh is symbolic of some sort of of sexual act or intimacy. The Achakach HaBeten, and then we go on to the Beten. So the metaphysical curse here is going to be that first, as a result of the Mayim Rorim, something's going to happen to her thigh, and ultimately it's going to happen to her belly, and it's going to her stomach, and something is going to be very, very tragic. So the Gemara now wants to know why are we starting with the thigh? Minani Mili, how do we know such a thing? Ilem Mishum Dechsiv. It says in the pasuk in Parashas Noso. It says Beseis Hashem Esirechech Nofeles. So first it mentions her thigh is going to fall, and then Vespitnech Tzava, and her belly is going to explode. So the Gemara says that's not a reason to start to start the when the Dayanim are announcing what's going to happen here, if she's guilty, to start with the Yerech, why not? Sounds like a pretty good proof. For Haksiv, the Pasuk says also in the same context, it says, V'tzavsa bitna v'nafli yerecha, that as a result of drinking, first her belly is going to explode, and only afterwards her Yerech is going to somehow collapse. Omar Abaye, Abaye says, Ki layit layit chila yerech v'hadar beten. But maya ki bodke ki archayu bodke beten v'resha v'hadar yerech. So the Gemara says the following, that when we curse her, and the Beis Din will tell her that if she's guilty as accused, then terrible things are going to happen after she drinks from the Mei Merarim, so that in that curse, we begin with the Yerech, and then we end with the Beten. Because we're going back to kind of like the source of her Avera. However, Kibmaya Kibodki, I'll be right with you, when the waters check her out, then Kirchayu, what's going to happen in a natural way is first she drinks and the water goes down to her belly, and after her belly explodes, that's Bereisha, that's first, then Hadar, secondly, Yerech. Then the Yerech itself is going to fall. So the Gemara, yeah, so what did you want to show me here?
Yeah, it finds the first problem is only to receive pressure for the first.
So again, the Avera itself starts with her thigh. For it is the first part of the body to come in contact with the body of the adulterer. Her stomach is next to receive pleasure. I don't know what he means by that, but anyway, when the Kohen curses her, he's going
to
mention. What did he say?
Explain it after.
Oh yeah, okay. So when the Kohen curses her, he starts with the thigh because that's where her avera begins. But as far as how the mayim is going to impact on her, the mayim is going to first start when it goes down to her stomach. So the Gemara says, "Bekloli namik siv." It says in the klola also. Let's just read the pasuk. He has it here on the side. Just give me a second here. Okay. Oh, I'm looking on the wrong column here. Just one second. Ubo amayim amaorim. This is when the Torah curses the woman. It says, "Ha'elu b'mei ayich." Litzvos beten v'linpol yerech. So it seems that even with regard to the klola, the divine curse, we start with the beten and then we go to the yerech. So why doesn't the Beis Din follow the lead of the Torah itself in the klola? And the Gemara answers, Hahu de moda la kohen. The kohen is in charge of notifying her what's going to happen to her. And so therefore he starts by notifying her that the beten is going to be blown up, and then that's Bereisha, and then Hadar afterwards, Yerech, it's going to affect the Yerech. Shalola hotzi laz almayim hamorim. In other words, when the Kohen is notifying her what's going to happen if she's guilty, and hopefully that she'll admit, she'll confess her crime, and then they don't need this whole procedure, right? And they don't have to destroy the name of Hashem. So he's going to tell her what's going to happen step by step, because if he doesn't tell her what's going to happen step by step, he's going to tell her where she messed up. In other words, which part of her body had a desire and was involved in this intimacy, and they'll start cursing her with the Yerech. Then what's going to happen is it's going to be motzi laz. I mean, people are going to see it didn't happen exactly the way they predicted it, because it first affected her beten, and only thereafter it affected her thigh. Now the next Mishnah is a very unusual Mishnah in that it doesn't seem to have any connection to the Masechta. You know, when Rebbe organized the Mishnayos, he went through the halachas of that Masechta. So we're learning the halachas of Sota. And at this point, the Mishnah seems to deviate from its path and asks the question about Shimshon. You know, why did Shimshon sin? And why was he punished in the way he was punished? And the way of understanding apparently the connection between this Mishnah and Sota is that since in Sota we're talking about Mida connected Mida, we're talking about the fact that she wanted to have something that she couldn't have that belonged to someone else, and therefore she, so the Mishnah now gives other examples of what we call Mida connected Mida. I'll just read the first line of the Mishnah. It says Shimshon Holach Achar Einov, and the Gemara is going to derive this later on from Psukim that Shimshon saw this woman and so forth and so on. Is Leficha therefore Nakru Plishtim as Einov? They would ultimately take out his eyes. Avshalom Nisgar Bisaro, he had beautiful hair, and therefore at the end he was Nitla Bisaro. He was punished. Do you remember when he's riding the horse and the branch, you know, caught onto his hair? And the Mishnah is going to go on and give other cases of Mida connected Mida. In a sense, this Mishnah is more Agadita than Halacha, and that really reflects on the whole Masechta sort of Masechta Sota. You know, if you just take a look, if you have a regular Gemara and you just start flipping pages, it's unbelievable. Sure. The entire perek, the whole chapter that we're learning, starting from Daf Tesen on, is all Agadita. Look at page Yud Gimel. I mean, I'd hate to have to teach this in Daf Yomi. I mean, it would take you 2 hours just to read through the page. Okay, Rabosai, so let's stop here. And we should all be zochet to be uplifted and inspired by the Agadita, by the messages here of ethics, of emuna, of faith, and in Mirtz Hashem, we won't see any sotas around. We're not looking forward to seeing a sota. I'd rather see a nazir than a sota. Did I ever tell you I met a nazir?
No.
I never told you? Yeah, his name was Cohen, was his last name. He was the disciple of Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi of Palestine. Nobody knows exactly why he became a nazir. But how did I come to meet him? He was sitting shiva. And they needed me to be Menachem Avil and to make a minyan, so I went into his shiva house. And for the first time in my life, and actually the only time in my life, I saw in front of me a nazir.
Is there anything prohibited about being a nazir?
No, I wouldn't recommend it unless you're really, you know, ready to hack it. I mean,
there's no process to get out of it, though.
Yeah, it depends what kind of naziris. There's Stam Naziris Shloshim Yom, and then you can take naziris for a limited amount of time. And there's something called the Nazir Olam. The different categories for that, you have to really learn the first parak of Nazir. I mean, most of the Nazir is Kodshim. I mean, Nazir is in Nashim, but it really belongs to Seder Kodshim.
This guy was a Nazir Olam.
I'm pretty sure he was, yeah. He died at an old age, I mean.
He never told
him. He had a lot of hair.
I was going to say, you could tell him because he was very hairy.
There were other rabbis who had a lot of hair because they didn't have time to take a haircut. But he was a Nazir.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, so Parshas B'Shalach is the Parsha of Emunah, the Parsha of Shtei Alechem, of the double portion of man that came down on Friday so that we would have a double portion for Shabbos. So we should all be zochet to a double portion of spirituality and materiality of everything, both Geshem and Ruah.
Yes, Rabbi, how did you enjoy your new assistant?
Oh, you did a great job. Yeah. But next week, Yaakov, I'm going to ask you for a super duper favor, if you don't mind. Yes. If not, I'll do it. If you can photocopy it, you'll either take the copy or you'll give me this.
I mean,
we managed with Rashi, thank God. I mean, Rashi did a pretty good job. But.